Talk.
I'm Walter.
Peter R. Breggin, M.D., is called the conscience of psychiatry for his many decades of successful reform efforts. His scientific and educational work provide the foundation for modern criticism of drugs and ECT, and lead the way in promoting more caring and effective therapies. His books include Talking Back to Prozac, Toxic Psychiatry, Medication Madness, Psychiatric Drug Withdrawal, and now, Guilt, Shame, and Anxiety, Understanding and Overcoming Negative Emotions. Welcome to the Dr. Peter Breggin Hour.
Hello, 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 my wonderful audience. By the way, I appreciate the increasing numbers of people who are getting in touch with me at BregginLive@hotmail.com. BregginLive@hotmail.com. I'll be, answering, and some of you have gotten answers already to some of the questions you send in, and some, if I don't answer, I just didn't know what to say. But I'm going to try to tell you that too when I can. I want to thank Cato from far away for telling me about Belgium and the story of this girl who wants euthanasia, and she's really a failure of society. She's a failure of psychiatry. It's just dreadful. I appreciate the heads up on that kind of a story. The idea of somebody seeking euthanasia because psychiatry has failed is like somebody going to a concentration camp and deciding that life is miserable. You know, psychiatry and concentration camps have much in common. The psychiatric holocausts, murder of hundreds of thousands of patients started before Hitler even gave it approval. It provided the equipment later for Hitler, took the equipment and used it for the larger Nazi extermination camps. I mean, really, to take that system of psychiatry, which in Europe especially has led to systematic murder of patients in my lifetime, and then to say, oh, therapy's not working, let's do euthanasia. And, that was basically the theme of the Holocaust as started by psychiatry, which was lives not worth living, lives that couldn't get anywhere, and lives that were expensive, too. Don't ever forget that. When you get the government heavily involved, then they want to cut expenses, too. And they really cut expenses in Nazi Germany, right? Eliminating the psychiatric population. It came back, though. It was one more proof that schizophrenia is not genetic. Oh, God, I'm laughing because it's so grim and awful. That this, the rate of schizophrenia, so-called schizophrenia, remained about the same after eliminating just about all the folks that had it and many of their relatives as well. So it's not a genetic thing. It varies depending on your environment, family life, and the communities. Somebody asked me about dystonia and dystonia of the chin and relaxing. Can you relax? And first of all, let me say that dystonia, most often probably in our culture now, is drug induced. And I don't think that the writer to BregginLive@hotmail.com said that whether or not it was. Relaxation will help any muscle spasm to some extent, but the dystonia is from central origin, and it isn't going to cure a dystonia, but drugs that cause relaxation, although they're going to wear off and they're addictive, give relief. Learning to relax gives relief. Anything a person can do, very mild exercise. But you need a good neurology consult, because sometimes there are injections that, if it's really bad, can give some relief. Lots of long-term problems and stuff that you have to consider, but you can get some relief. And a number of people responded to my discussion on the radio show about having a a conference in Ithaca. One person even promised a boatload of, not a boatload, we live on the water, but it'd be hard to get a boatload here, a busload of people to come in. So I'm going to think about it for the future, but it's going to be a little bit from the future. The bird count today is a little low. I'm looking out the window. It's changing seasons out the window, yellows, reds, greens, browns, and just a handful of little brown birds coming by, kind of dusky-looking goldfinches and sparrows occasionally, and some wet-looking chickadees. Life is good. Life is good. And life is better because of my two guests today. We won't be taking callers because the phones will be tied up by having two guests. So you won't be able to get through for callers. But remember, last Wednesday of the month and 4 p.m. on the Dr. Peter Bregan Hour, New York time. And you can call in at 888-874-4888. But not today. And you won't miss the call in today's because we have Pam Popper and Pinar Miski here. Are you both there?
I'm here. It's Pam.
We are.
Oh, my
Hi
God.
There.
Your voices, they're like music. I mean this really. Really, they're like music. They just make me feel good. Just those little chirps. I don't have a... I always forget to talk about my friends and who they are because I feel you know them. They've been on a fair amount of time. But, of course, many of you just dropping in for the first time. Pinar Miski, M-I-S-K-I. She's a psychiatrist in Baltimore, Maryland. She's affiliated with St. Agnes Hospital in Baltimore. She went to medical school in Philly at Temple. And she's been practicing, she says, between 11 and 20 years. I'm not sure what that means. What does that mean, Pinar?
It means I can't do math, probably.
Or maybe something went wrong with my computer. And Pinar Miski is a gift to me in my life from Pam Popper. And then Pinar Miski has given me the gift of being the online teacher of my biggest course, which is about psychiatric drug withdrawal and really all of my views about psychiatry. And then Pam Popper, who she's the reason I have the course and has done all the work around it except for the 20 or so videos that I put together by coming to visit her and talking in front of an audience in her hometown in Columbus, Ohio. So these are wonderful people. And Pam is holding a conference. I'm co-conference person, but not really. Pam, at this point, is being very kind and puts my name up on the lights. But I will only be there by video, folks. You need to know that. I'm not traveling now. I've decided it's too tiring to travel. My doctors think it's too tiring to travel, even though I'm in very good health, but I'm 83. I don't see people running around for planes like I had to do my last time out. But I can imagine at some point I might do a very limited travel, like maybe next year to Pam's conference. But I'm good. I'm good. My health is fine. The glitches that I got traveling are gone. I just don't want to bring them back. I don't want to get overtired. But I love both of these people. Pam is the founder and president of Wellness Forum. And just go look at it. Look up Pam Popper, look up Wellness Forum. She has a practice that she conducts where she doesn't give out medical advice, but she shows you and makes accessible to you all the information, the scientific information you need to help you make your informed medical decisions, which is her entire emphasis. It's the Wellness Forum Health, and Pam's a great reformer, too. She's a lot like me. She's just out there doing what she thinks is good to do. She's a lot better organizer than me, and I write more books than she does, so I don't know, maybe that's a trade-off, Pam. So hi to my friends. Hello. Who wants to say something about their day? Kinnar. Pam, how's your day?
My day's fabulous. So my kitty got acupuncture today.
Oh, my God.
He has a veterinary acupuncturist that comes to the house. So, you know, just a little bit of background for people who don't know. My kitty is 15. His name is Schroeder. You've met Schroeder, Peter.
Of course I've met Schroeder.
Everybody's met Schroeder. Even on, if you've never been to my house, you've met him on the phone because he meows frequently during classes. But he has stage 3 kidney disease. He's 15 years old, which is now a disease that cats can live with for a long time. He gets sub-Q fluids and acupuncture, and he takes this special oil that I get from Canada. And so anyway, today was acupuncture day, and so I got to go home for lunch with Schroeder and have the vet come over, and I just filmed some lectures, and so I'm doing my thing and having a great day. I love what I do.
It's really wonderful. Pam works all day long and half the night and eats well, and Pam is the person who got me on a, not entirely yet, but very largely a plant-based whole food low-fat diet. I mean, I am really on that diet. It's been very good for my health as well. I've been doing good. How about you, Pinar? How's your day?
I can't say it's as eventful as a cat getting acupuncture, but it's definitely up there, and I'm loving life, too. I mean, I'm actually enjoying the rain. I'm happy for the trees that they finally get some water around here, and like you, enjoying the colors and nature, and, you know, going about my day, seeing patients, trying to be a superheroine as usual.
Can't complain. And you do consults, and I think that is very interesting. And let's talk a little bit about just what you've been learning from going on to hospital wards as a consultant. That's my understanding of what you do, and the kinds of lessons you're getting from the people you see coming in who have been mangled by psychiatrists or other doctors, and what you're able to do as a consultant on the wards.
So, yeah, it is. I am in a unique position to be aware of a lot of the things that, you know, come up that we teach in your course. I think compared to a lot of other psychiatrists, I do see more of the medication side effect side of things, or at least I'm more, at least I'm more aware of those things. And basically, I think I end up, you know, not only being, I don't hardly ever get any phone calls
what is
at
that?
All, and here I am, like, I have no idea. I hope that went to my messaging system. So, obviously, I'm very busy. So, basically, like, what I see any number of things, you know, people as acute as after suicide attempts to having, like, needing medication management. We're not far from a state psych hospital, so when people run into trouble with their side effects, they're coming in here. It can be a little difficult sometimes because I'm only in the acute care setting, so when people leave the hospital, I kind of, it's a bit out of my hands as to what happens, and people constantly, you know, asking me, well, who do I go to, you know, to manage medications, and I'm still somewhat at a loss. You know, I wish I could find more plant-based physicians in my area to, you know, like-minded folks. I wish I could find more people in mental health that still have faith in psychotherapy and the power of the human mind to think its way out of many of the situations that lead to what we view as depression and anxiety and all that stuff. But, you know, that's kind of the you know, two-minute version of what I do on a day-to-day basis. But these were not necessarily things that I'd say were emphasized during my residency training. I was lucky. I did have some clinicians that I trained under who were aware of these things. So were, you know, I still use some of their the way they sell, not sell, but the way they present psych meds and their side effects. And I still present things the way that they taught me because they were truths. And at the time I wasn't really appreciative of it, but the more I see folks who come in here after years of medications and the effects of that, you know, I'm a lot more aware of these things. And it is frustrating, though, also, like, increasingly hospitals are, at least here in Maryland, being put in a situation of borderline political overtones where we're kind of, you know, insurance companies not wanting to pay for certain things, and then the hospitals you know, the overlap between things like adverse childhood experiences, what people are experiencing socially, and how that leads to health consequences. And I'm becoming extremely aware of these things. You know, I know, Peter, you've said that, oh, if the person has like an addictions issue, there's almost always something else going on, and they might not be verbalizing it, they might not be psychologically aware of it. And it's very, very true. Like, I think a lot of times people kind of block out certain things, and they might not understand why they're doing it, but there's usually very good reasons for why people do what they do. And a lot of times it is life experiences and what society has done to them, indirectly or directly. Not as extreme of an example as like what you were saying with the concentration camps, but, you know, poverty is associated with a lot of these chronic illnesses. And part of that is poor nutrition, poor self-care, the effects of chronic stress. And sometimes it can be frustrating as a clinician not to have any control over that. And we had a grand rounds with some gentleman from Johns Hopkins, and he was encouraging us to get politically active and, you know, advocate on behalf of our patients and try to make policy changes to make things more, you know, better for society in terms of their health. It's just, I guess there's still debate about certain things, you know, and people are still kind of in denial about a lot of things as well. And so those are the things on my mind on a day-to-day basis at work here.
Do you find any colleagues who are genuinely sympathetic to the need to reduce medications or even stop them?
Actually, I have, and surprisingly, not too many. Specifically, over at the nursing homes, there is pressure to certainly lay off of things like the heavy-duty antipsychotics and things like that. And so I have, you know, spoken with colleagues who are doing consultations at nursing homes, and they're very mindful to try to get people off of these things. But, you know, again, it's very frustrating because we work as consultants in, well, maybe not so much my colleagues in the nursing homes, but certainly where I work, you know, people are in and out of the hospital in very short periods of time, and trying to get off of some of these drugs if you've been on them your whole life, or a very large portion of your life, and if you're on them at very high dosages, can be tricky and potentially even dangerous. And so people just get convinced that they can't, you know, that they can't possibly come off of them, and they get very discouraged. And so I kind of lean towards what Pam does, which is the education piece and making them aware, you know, have you read the drug inserts, like the monographs, the information that's out there about, you know, what the potential side effects can be and the risks and the benefits, and just allowing people to make their own decisions for themselves about what they want to try. And there are still invariably a few people here and there who are just like, no, I just want the pill. I don't have time for therapy or whatever. And it's their right, but I feel like as a clinician, it's not my job to live their life for them. It's my job to give them the information and, you know, let them do what they choose with it.
I have a wonderful question for you, Pinar, and then I want to bring in Pam. Pinar, if you were to go into private practice, which mm-hmm. I think would be wonderful for you, at least part-time, but if you were to go into private practice, would you run it drug-free? What would you do? Where are you in that regard now?
I have in the past, like, occasionally thought about it, because I know there seems to be a high demand for it. And I'm kind of like you, Peter. I might not be the most well-organized person in the universe, and that's kind of what holds me back from it. I'm not the most business-minded, savvy person in the world. And I also, the other thing that keeps me from it is I feel ethically, at least where I'm practicing in the Baltimore, D.C. area, a lot of psychiatrists, I guess, to stay afloat, kind of, they charge by the hour, and the rates that they end up charging end up being kind of unaffordable for the average person, even the average middle-class working person. And I kind of object to that on some level. Like, I kind of, maybe I'm too hippy-dippy-ish, I don't know, but, like, I kind of wish that more people could get that kind of help, and that's another reason why I kind of stay in the hospital setting. But that being said, I would certainly have to beef up my psychotherapy skills, but, you know, based on your teachings, I think I possess the basic skills needed to be a decent therapist. And for those of you who haven't seen Peter's book, but the Heart of Being Helpful is really interesting. It's an interesting take on what is most important to possess as a psychotherapist. So if anybody out there is a therapist and is curious about what empathic therapy is, I really feel like, you know, over the years it was interesting because I had so many patients who would be getting better, and I always just automatically assumed, oh, I must be like a genius at, you know, psychopharmacology. Like I'm inherently talented at just messing around with these drugs and just getting them doing better, when in reality, in retrospect, it was totally the principles behind what you were saying in your book, and I was just intuitively doing it and listening and being present with the patient and not being afraid to, you know, be there when they're in pain and giving them feedback and support. And, you know, that's what was getting them better, not really the drugs per se. And so I do think that I would run a practice based on informed decision making and making sure people knew, you know, with the drugs, like if the drugs were necessary, kind of like you, like short-term courses of things to help with sleep and whatnot, but really trying to work with them on certain concrete goals. And of course, if they don't make any headway with it, maybe referring them to other colleagues to try different styles of psychotherapy, as any other good clinician would. I've vaguely contemplated it. It's just not really something that's come up as realistic for me for those reasons that I listed earlier. But
although I'm not very organized, I certainly have been able to organize a psychiatric practice since 1966 is when I first started my practice while I was at NIMH. So that I can organize. I mean, I'm not so good on conferences, but I can organize a practice, and it's not hard at all to run a psychiatric practice compared to other practices. So if you ever decide that you do think maybe it's time to go into private practice, let go of the idea you couldn't organize it, because I think just a few hours of you and I talking would lay out all the organization you ever needed to run a practice, to get patients, and so on, and to start it very inexpensively. I want to make clear to my audience that I actually never start people on psychiatric drugs. I think that what you were referring to when you suggested I use them occasionally is that once every few years I might give somebody a sleeping medication for 3 nights because they are heading into a psychotic mania, and usually just helping them get a little sleep and giving them a few free sessions in addition to the regular one is enough to help them get through it. So I really don't use the drugs, essentially. I mean, sleeping meds are just sleeping meds, and people take them all the time. I don't prescribe them regularly, but I will, I mean, literally every few years, you know, when I have somebody who's coming to me in a manic state. People rarely develop a manic state once they've seen me. I had that one time with somebody who'd just been seeing me for 2 weeks or something. Because once they get a relationship going, and folks, if you saw Pinar, if this was filmed, she's just a shining spirit. I mean, when Pinar smiles, it looks like an angel's touching you. So I'm sure that that just your glow, which is loving and caring, and so intelligent and so on and so forth, Pinar is it's like fairy dust. What do you think, Bam?
So
am I exaggerating?
No, I don't think so. And I would echo that. And I think that there are some people who just have a reassuring aura about them and who are basically the message, you know, there's so much messaging and communication that goes on that's not spoken. It's the way the person sits, smiles, carries themselves, the whole nine yards. And I think that, you know, if I was really in trouble, I was severely depressed or anxious or whatever was going on, you know, my hope would be that the type of person that I would that I would be talking to about my problems would be somebody like you or somebody like Pinar, who I would feel, this person cares about me, this person wants to help me. If the whole world's against me, this person's on my side. And I think that's sometimes what's missing. And by the way, it's not limited to the psychiatric profession. I mean, I hear stories in this office all day long of cancer patients who are abused by oncologists. And I don't even, you know, I don't know that oncologists get up in the morning and say, I'm going to go terrorize cancer patient today, but they just don't realize you're dealing with somebody at a really fragile time in their life. You've just been diagnosed with cancer and you're dismissive and you don't have time. And I remember one story that just horrified me by way of example. This oncologist got impatient with this woman who was sitting in his office with her husband and said, well, we got to get the show on the road because I'm going on vacation on Friday. And so, you know, you need to make up your mind what you're going to want to do because I'm going on vacation. She said, you're asking me to time my treatments around your vacation. And he goes, well, I'm just saying I'm leaving Friday, you know. And it almost takes your breath away that you would behave like that in front of somebody. And my gosh, I think that people, when you take your car in to be fixed, you expect better treatment than that, you know. So our whole profession really needs a big revamping in terms of teaching compassion and what it's like to show up mentally and emotionally present and just say with just your whole aura, I'm here for you. The only thing I'm paying attention to is you, and whatever's going on with you, I just want to help you with it.
I think that's absolutely true. And the thing is, folks, if you take that approach yourself to the people you're dealing with in any way, whether it's your partner or your children or your clients in any profession, and you greet them the way the Quakers say, you know, greet that of God in them, greet them like valid spirits, greet them like God loves them too, greet them like you would greet a puppy you loved, that you will be happier and you will create happiness around you. You will carry an aura around you that brings happiness, because people don't walk around feeling they deserve love. I'm just writing about that now, Pinar. I'm talking with Pinar Miski and Pamela Popper, Pam Popper. I think the deepest thing that people suffer from, I'm just writing about this in what will become a blog and a book chapter, God willing. And that is, I think that maybe the deepest hurt of all is feeling that you're unworthy of love. You're unlovable. I think that the psychotic youngster who's curled up in her bedroom with a pillow over her head, you know, hallucinating, if you could convince her she was lovable or he was lovable, or deserving of love, they're a little different, I suppose, deserving of love, you would begin their healing. And the same with a person who's manic and out of control and acting like they are God and saying they're God and saying that they are the strongest people in the world, the most successful people in the world, and being very touchy and irritable, and that if you could settle them down and have them talk with them, they feel the opposite. They feel like they're unlovable and undeserving of love. And I think that's the deepest thing. And when you care for somebody, you give them that gift that they're both lovable and deserving of love. And I'm glad I'm talking about this because I'm making a distinction between feeling unlovable and feeling undeserving of love, which are kind of different in some ways. And I know I feel that way. I mean, you'd think, oh, hey, Peter Bregan didn't have to struggle with that. But when I see one of my docs and they're warm and caring, and we've managed to gather around us pretty much doctors who are that way, I feel better. Ginger feels better. We feel reinforced about being valuable human beings. And, you know, you think, well, valuable, look at all you've done in the world, Peter. I think the ultimate feeling of being a valuable human being comes out of relationships. not out of accomplishments, comes out of a loving, caring relationships. And that's where I think God's very important. I won't talk a lot about that. Maybe some of you will email me at breganlive@hotmail.com and tell me you want me to talk about God. If I get a few of those, I might. But these are the key issues, I think, in our lives. So whenever we're, even if we're, what you're doing, Pam, you're encouraging people to eat better, it tells them they matter. It tells them they matter. What do you mean, eat better? Do I deserve to eat better and to prolong my life and to have a healthier life, or am I not worthy? What do you, both of you, start with Pam to get it good. What do you think of that idea?
Well, I agree. In fact, I think one of the reasons why people don't take care of themselves is because they don't see themselves as valuable. You know, one of the people don't live in their bodies anymore. And they don't look at their bodies. They don't look at most of anything in life as a gift. And I used to be this way too. I mean, I think it's common, and part of it's just youthful stupidity. I don't know what else to call it. But as we grow up and we gain some maturity, I think that we need to look at the blessings in our lives, because whatever else is going wrong, if you have a fully functioning body, just think about that for a minute, how lucky you are compared to somebody who's paralyzed, right? And you would think that you would feel that it's worthwhile to take care of that body. But we don't take the time to appreciate how lucky we are to have a fully functioning body that's worth taking care of, or that we're worth taking care of. So, and I see particularly women, I think it's a, you know, not to sound too sexist, but I think it's a condition of women to say, I'm going to take care of everything and everybody first before me, and maybe always and never me. And that's not good. That's not good at all. It's not a good perspective to have.
Oh, I think you're absolutely right. I feel like I have to almost daily encourage Ginger to take care of herself, and especially since we invited her mom to live with us, and her mom's been here now a couple of years, but just me alone, Gingy, take care of yourself, sweetheart. I think that women very easily get into that, and Gingy remembers getting into that when she was 6 years old, and her mother suggested to her, when her daughter said, I have to go to potty, her second daughter, Ginger's younger sister, and her mom said, oh, Ginger will take you to the potty. And that was the beginning. I'm sure she never said that to her son, her youngest child or son. So it starts really early that's what you're supposed to do as a woman. And it's very gratifying, can be deeply gratifying, but can also be something that's put upon a person in a compulsive way and much too young. Yeah. What do you think, Pinar Miski, about love and about this idea that I'm thinking more and more, that it's feeling unworthy of love and unlovable, that lies at the root of so much of personal misery?
Now, I completely agree with you, and I think that it ties in totally to the adverse childhood experience of study that I was alluding to earlier. You know, when
repeat what you said. What study?
Oh, the Adverse Childhood Experiences study by Vince Felitti.
Can you? I don't actually know that. There's a lot of good stuff in that area, but I don't know that. Spell the last name if you can. Which is
Adverse Childhood Experiences.
Okay.
And the primary, there were two head authors, but I guess the main one is Vince. Felitti, F-E-L-I-T-T-I, really wonderful clinician. He's an internist, and he was working with the Kaiser Group, and he had, Pam will find this interesting, there was this weight loss study where they had morbidly obese individuals and put them on caloric restriction, and they were all losing weight as anticipated, but then a subset of these folks dropped out of the study. And unlike a lot of other clinicians, Dr. Felitti was just like, you know, I need to know what's going on. So he pursued his curiosity, didn't let it slide. He called. He reached out to the people who dropped out of the weight loss program and kind of asked them, you know, you were doing great. You were losing weight. What's going on? And time after time, these individuals would tell Dr. Felitti things like, oh, well, you know, overeating was how I dealt with whatever happened in my childhood, like, you know, be it sexual abuse or whatever, or overeating and being obese makes me unattractive to the opposite sex so I can't get raped again. Or it just kept tying into all these horrible experiences that these individuals had had in the course of their life. And I think he basically ended up creating a study of this. And there was a lot of opposition. I guess the IRB wasn't thrilled with the idea of you're going to ask people about whether you've been sexually abused or beaten or whatever in your childhood. And, you know, people did not want to hear this. But when he created this 10-item questionnaire, and there have been expanded versions of this questionnaire, and he basically had a middle-class population that was basically a slice of America. They were working class, college-educated for the most part, racial distribution similar to the whole population of the U.S., and tens of thousands of people, I think around 20,000 people, filled this questionnaire out, and it was absurd how many people had gone through these horrible events in their lifetime. And when they, most interestingly enough, studied the outcomes of these experiences, this is kind of what I was alluding to about, I'm seeing the end stages of this, diabetes, cancer, heart disease, dementia, you name it, because individuals that are caught in the cycle often find themselves psychologically distressed, self-medicating with drugs, you know, medicating by eating badly. I know Pam doesn't necessarily believe food's an addiction, but I kind of lean towards you know, it is a chemical, you take it in, and it does modify how you feel temporarily, and it can provide some people a source of comfort sometimes. So in my mind, it is an addiction. But, and I think it just, it was baffling, like, the epidemiologic study that they conducted. Like, these were numbers, like, tens of thousands of, like, you know, increases in risk for IV drug use when you've had this stuff happen to you. It's common sense, though. It is kind of intuitive. But the thing that all of the, like, the study has in common is that when you have these bad things happen to you, inherently it changes how you view yourself. And just like you said, Peter, like, you feel like you're not worthy of love. There's something wrong with you, that these horrible things have happened to you. And it's a huge fallacy that I think a lot of people feel with their lives. You know, we have this idea, and it's somewhat protective, that only bad things happen to bad people. So if I'm a good person, bad stuff can happen to me. And it's completely illogical, but since when have humans been logical? And the converse of that, of course, is that if bad things have happened to you, then you're bad. And I think that's where a lot of the cycle kind of starts out for individuals. And it leads to really bad places and, you know, contributes to a lot of healthcare issues down the road. And again, I just saw an individual today told me that his parents would have fistfights in front of him when he was younger. And surprise, surprise, he too has become an alcoholic and going blind from diabetes and all sorts of other horrible things after a lifetime of heavy drinking. And unfortunately, these things are also very multi-generational. You know, people experience this growing up. You know, there's no class for what you deserve as a child, what you need in your childhood. You know, parents are allowed to do what they feel is appropriate. And so subsequently, as we grow up, we think, okay, whatever our parents did to us was kind of the norm, the standard. Even if those things were abusive, it's not like we go to school and talk about what mom and dad did at home all the time. And so I think it's kind of unfortunate that, you know, this gentleman is just, you know, I'm asking him, like, why were you drinking heavily? And not one, it took until, like, near the end of the interview when I specifically said, well, what was your childhood like? And he kind of brought up what was going on at home with his parents having fist fights. And it was just kind of, I mean, I wasn't surprised. That's why I kind of pressed the question. But you can imagine how most clinicians wouldn't have even asked the question. But I've gotten to the point where I realize people don't mind answering these questions. And if you don't ask these questions, if you don't talk about it, it comes out in other ways, either through your body or through your behaviors. Either way, it's a bad mix. And so this study, in my mind, was just so incredibly important. And Peter, if you don't know about it, you have to look into it, because so much of psychiatry is kind of rooted in these experiences that people have. I'm not going to say everything I see relates to it, but so much of what I see relates to it.
Oh, I'm going to definitely get that book, but there's a huge literature. I've written it down, so it's safe. But there's a huge literature on that. I mean, back in the 70s, there was a huge book on the adverse events in childhood of people who become psychotic. I mean, way back then, there were already enough studies to do summary chapters on the trauma and childhood and neglect and abuse and so on. That and its relationship to psychosis later in life, which is totally ignored by, I mean, totally ignored by modern psychiatry. One more piece of evidence, folks, that modern psychiatry has nothing to do with science at all. It's a method of pushing drugs, electroshock. Now they're coming out with these newfangled electrical electrodes they're going to put on the heads of our children. And by the way, you can, please, if you have any interest in saving our children, go to my website, Bregan.com. And just spin down a few items, and you'll see a big, awful-looking thing, and it stands for the Monarch, which is this new device to put on the heads of children, and we're trying to fight it. And I've set up an organization called the Stop the Psychiatric Abuse of Children, SPAC, which I would love, by the way, Pinar, in your extra time, to see if you'd like to get involved with Stop the Psychiatric Abuse of Children. We can email about that, talk about that. I don't want you being pressed to say anything on the air. And I also want to remind people that this issue about love, I do write about that in, it's very kind of Pinar to mention, The Heart of Being Helpful. And I write about it extensively. The whole last third of my book called Guilt, Shame, and Anxiety, the whole last third is about becoming a source of love and accepting love and how that will transform your life. So the whole last third of the Guilt, Shame, and Anxiety. And the first third has a lot in it about adverse childhood experiences with an awful lot of references. So that's something I'm really immersed in, Pinar, deeply immersed in, but this sounds like a really especially good study. Pam, are you still there? Have we driven you away?
No, I am still here. And it's interesting, you're talking about these childhood experiences, and I'll tell you something recent that I've done a lot of research on. I created a course on irritable bowel, different from inflammatory bowel. And with irritable bowel, the interesting thing, well, there's so many interesting things about it, but one of them is that people have these very uncomfortable gastrointestinal symptoms, but there are no abnormalities in a blood test, and there are no abnormalities that show up in x-rays or colonoscopies or endoscopies. And, you know, sometimes people are sent away and they're told it must be in your head. It's not in their head. But, there's a long story. I mean, there are 7 lectures in this series. But the take-home point that's related to what you've been talking about is that a significant percentage, almost half of the mostly women who have irritable bowel, have been sexually or physically abused in some way, usually going back to childhood. And so what ends up happening is that they internalize a lot of pain. They're hypersensitive to pain. And sometimes sickness is a way to get attention from people when you don't get attention any other way. So this becomes a learned behavior to a certain extent in response to incredible dysfunction as a child. And so you can just imagine how frustrating it is for the typical IBS patient who's hanging out with gastroenterologists who are saying, there's nothing the matter with you. When there's clearly something the matter, we're just not talking about what it is, you know. Mm-hmm. So, and I think that this is probably true of many other diseases, too. And Kelly Turner's book on terminal cancer patients who survive, they almost all felt that they had a life lesson to learn, some imbalance in relationships, and some of it going back to childhood and family relationships that were all messed up and this kind of thing. So I think in all areas of life, in all biological diseases even, this origin of problems that relate back to the family and many times to childhood, people carry it through life unless they know specifically how to not do that. And as Pinar said, we don't teach this in school. We don't teach it anywhere. What happens is you, if you're lucky, and this is a way of looking at it, if you're lucky enough to get screwed up enough that you end up in a therapist's office or some kind of intervention, you're forced to have an intervention of some type, you might get to sort this all out. But you could also go through life sort of in this subclinical, just miserable with the world at large and just have your whole life be that way, which would be so distressing. I mean, I think about it just makes me sad to think about people living that way.
Yeah. There's a lot of sadness in the world. I'm just reading a book. I'm not even going to really mention the name because it's a tough book to read. But it's about people who survived the Gulag and the Nazi extermination camps. And the Gulag, which had had death rates so high, they might as well, in Russia, USSR, and they still have them, but might have rivaled the extermination camps. And the people who choose to write about it and who have survived, they talk about surviving on the basis of they're still being able at moments when it was safe enough that they wouldn't get killed on the spot to express some kindness to others, and in a surprising way to get some kindness from others. I think that is so profound that the people who choose to write about their survival in these horrendous conditions, where the whole point is to completely demoralize you.
There's a great book that I really recommend everybody read called The Tattooist of Auschwitz. Have you heard about it?
No. Mm-hmm.
Oh, it's wonderful. It's a New York Times best-selling book, and it's written by a woman whose parents met each other at Auschwitz. And he was the tattooist. He was, tattooing the numbers on the arms. And a first-hand account. I've read several books written by people who were there, and it's just hard to imagine surviving it. And the book is about their love story and how they got out of the camp and found each other afterwards, and that whole thing. But it was also about the way that the camp was the culture that was going on beneath the surface at the camp, which the Nazis were so focused on being terrible they never even noticed, which was exactly what you're talking about, people finding ways to enjoy things and to do things for each other. And they had things being smuggled into the camp that nobody knew about. And so it's a wonderful, hopeful story of humans surviving and overcoming and actually living a beautiful life even in the camp. They found a lot of happiness with each other, So hard to think about a love story in Auschwitz, but that's what it is.
that's interesting, Pam, because I've never heard that in all of my reading and talking about people finding any happiness in the camp. So that is really interesting.
They made up their mind. They were intent on surviving. And one of the things, I've watched a couple of documentary movies recently, too, about this kind of thing. And one of the things that the people in the camp did is they protected each other. So, for example, if you were sick in the camp, they would just put you to death. So they had all kinds of ways of compensating for each other and figuring out a way to get extra food. Like everybody would give up a bite of their bread and give it to the person who was sick and this kind of thing. And they saved lives that way because really if you had anything wrong with you, if you had a fever today, they just shoot you in the yard, So this ability to protect people from certain death and keep them working, keeping people working when they were starving and sick took all out effort, and it was a group effort, So the people got close to the people they were in, they slept 10 to a bed. I mean, a bed like twice the size of the bed I sleep in by myself with a cat. So you got pretty close to the people, and they protected each other. And so you would think that in that environment, what would happen is everybody for themselves. Listen, I'm just doing my best to survive. If I can steal your bread and get an extra bite, maybe I'll live longer. That's not what was going on most of the time at all.
Well, that's a good view, and I've heard certainly of some of that, but not with as much emphasis as you're giving it. So I suppose one step would be to get a hold of that book. I'm not sure I want to read another book about the camps and so on. It's we're all empaths who listen to this show, probably. Oh my God!
Well, I can only read so much of that, and then I need a break from it. But once in a while, I guess I'm kind of in that mode of never forget, And so I.
Well, I'm in that mode. Go ahead, Gunnar.
Oh, I'm sorry. I somewhat related, but kind of unrelated. But I just after the last show where I called in a couple weeks ago, I think on the 9th of this month. And Pam and I were talking, and you ended the show off with the interesting question of, I'm mostly plant-based, but I still occasionally enjoy locks in the morning or whatever, and that's like my one big joy in the day. And I think that that kind of ties into this in many ways. Number one, feeling like you're worthy enough to enjoy something that strongly. And I think also it kind of ties into this in the sense that, like, we do have to have joy in our lives. We do. And even if that only joy is the relationship you have with others, you're all in the same boat. You can't take our love away. Screw you. You know, that could be the one and only thing that those individuals had. They didn't have their freedom, but they still had their minds. They still decided, we're going to have love. They'll never take that away. That's such a beautiful thought. And that really pervades all of humanity. And for you know, the question that you asked,
well,
I mean,
just
if
well
you,
put,
if you,
let me say that, well put. Go ahead.
If you look at the longest lived, functionally longest lived individuals at the conference, the Wellness Forum conference last year, we had an individual talking about the blue zones and, you know, the people in Okinawa, Sardinia, Ikaria, all those places where people live to 100 years of age functionally. They all had that sense of community, that sense of love, that sense of purpose, belonging. They also had a source of joy in their lives. So we know intellectually eating that salmon is probably not the most heart-healthy thing for you, but at the same time, you have to have joy. You have to feel like you're worthy of something, and that goes a long way. And I think everybody is totally entitled to that, you know?
Well, some people think it's good for you. I know that Pam feels that research is, and you're such a great evaluator of research. It makes me think, see, locks, it's locks. It's cold, smoked, Pacific salmon, and it's lox. And in my childhood, there were almost just nothing to remember and talk about, really. That's good. Very little. And one of the things I do remember is occasionally my parents would go out to the Jewish deli, and I would get to eat smoked fish. And I haven't thought so much about this except for this moment. And I think that that was something that I thought at probably at the time when I grew up and I can buy what I want to eat, I'm going to have more smoked fish. And and I've settled on lox, but I think some of it was whitefish and some of it was sable and so on. Oh, my God. I love talking with the three of you, three of us. And again, we're talking with Pinar Miski and Pam Popper. And folks, give me a little note to breganlive@hotmail.com because my tendency in life would be to get together more frequently on the air with Pam and Pinar if they have the time because that's what I love. I love to talk to my dearest friends and to get into areas I have no idea. We had no pre-discussion about what we were going to talk about today, and I had love on my mind, which is not uncommon. So that's part of the reason we went in that direction. But let me know what you think about these kinds of discussions, whether you look forward to once a month, or once every 6 weeks, or whatever, to having me on with my two dear friends, and or occasionally with some other friends that I've had on over the years and had them on a few times. I think that's, to me, life is most about that. When we come to happiness and confidence, it's the loving relationships in our lives that give us so far and away the most strength. And we all do it in different ways. Pam is amazing. She's, I'd say, a profound extrovert. I don't know if she agrees. And she has so many people around her who love her. And I want to ask Pinar where she is on this spectrum, if it's a spectrum. And her deep personal love at home is Schroeder, the cat. But Pam just has, every day goes to work, and there are people who love her and so on and so forth. And then, of course, she also has people all over the world. I have a small group of people who I love and love me, and it's bigger than it's ever been because Mom is here, and Mom has a couple of caretakers that we've arranged for their companions. and an assistant. So we have like four or five people, really love each other. I don't have a need for going out and meeting a lot of people. I like my time to write my books and do my radio show and so on and so forth. Pinar, where do you get your most of your satisfaction of closeness and love from?
Well, of course, there's my husband, there's the pet parrot. But I also, I think maybe through art, that's kind of my version of spirituality. So I really adore the arts, music. I'm highly involved with my local Weavers Guild. I feel like art kind of taps into things that are kind of beyond words in many ways. And I learned so much about myself through it. And I really highly value that. I think that kind of grounds me and keeps me connected to the universe at large in ways that I can't really express very well.
Well, I'm so glad you bring that in, because that's a small part of my life compared to others. I love nature. You know, I always introduce the show almost always about what's happening outside through my glass window onto the deep woods and to my feeders. But the other thing I left out is my clients. I mean, since 1968, I have had people that I feel as warmly about as the dearest friends and even family in my practice. And that is just so important to me. I've never been without it. I've rarely been away for a week from my patients over these many, many years. So that's very close again. That's close. And, wow, any closing thoughts? We got about a minute left. I just love talking with you guys.
I'll just give you one closing thought. You mentioned earlier about doing this more often, and I'd love to. I enjoy this kind of conversation, and I think it's sometimes good to not have an agenda and just see where things go. It's wonderful to do that sometimes.
Yeah, there was zero one today, but see, I always bring on what's on my mind, and what's on my mind today is a lot about writing about the deepest threats of not being lovable or not deserving love. And so we got into that some, and that probably will always happen. Hi, Pinar, your thoughts? You get closing thoughts.
Nothing profound. I think I kind of agree. I really enjoy these conversations. I learn about you guys and about other topics in general. So thank you so much. This is so stimulating for me.
Great. Wonderful. Love having you out there to listen, folks. Love my audience. Love having you out there. And, you know, let me say it. God bless all of you. And if God for you is just a wonderful nature and spirit, that's fine. Whatever greater than yourself experience you have in life, may you have it. Bye-bye, everybody.
Bye.
Bye-bye.